There we are. That's Mr. Vin Peebles. And we are joined by Norman Ortiz Richmond. Are you there, Norman?
Yes, sir. How are you?
Very good. Well, you and I both attended a talk by Fred Anderson, and he is the author of Eyes Have Seen, From Mississippi to Montreal, a memoir published by Baraka. I was really impressed with the talk, and of course, the book, because he focuses on something that I know you are, it's the center of your thinking, the broad struggle against racism, the particular earthquake that happened in the 1960s when a decision was taken by tens of thousands to bring an end to Jim Crow, not just in the South, but of course your origins, beginnings are Los Angeles. Your people are from Louisiana and elsewhere. I don't want to go completely into it. You'll tell me. But what your impressions of Fred Anderson, what it brings to mind with you, Fred Anderson, his book Eyes Have Seen.
I think the first thing I realized was that the whole narrative that comes about people from Mississippi is that the ruling circles in America has painted the quote-unquote Mississippi Negro as the slowest. We see a white man, we want to run, and we see a white woman, we start lusting. That's the basically Mississippi quote-unquote Negroes were among, if not the dumbest set of African people in the world. How else could we be in the richest country in the world and be in the condition that we are in? I remember always growing up talking about hearing people talking about Mississippi in that light, and then on the other hand, I remember people talking about somebody getting a Mississippi ass whooping. The Mississippi people were known to be able to rumble.
Uh-huh.
And
not a widely known thing, actually.
Oh yeah, there's a book called "We Will Fight Back." I'm having a senior moment. Mm-hmm. Akinyele, brother a brother from Los Angeles, from Compton, I believe he's from Compton. Akinyele wrote a book called "We Will Fight Back" about the armed struggle in Mississippi. He's from Compton, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. but when I read Fred Anderson's book, and the whole thing about black people from Mississippi, the whole thing about being able to run, jump, and all of that, we proved that because I was just watching the 1964 Olympics, and there was a man by the name of Ulysses Williams. He went to Centennial High School, which is in Compton High School. He may be retired now, but he became the principal, or I guess in the Caribbean they would call him the headmaster. He was running things at either Centennial or Compton High School. He ran the third leg on the U.S. Olympic team. They won the Olympic, won the gold medal in the relay, and I think it was Henry Carr. I think Carr was out of Detroit. He anchored that particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember like people like David Ruffin and Bobby Rogers. The reason I mentioned them, Ruffin is from Mississippi, and Bobby Rogers is from Louisiana. But the reason I mentioned those three names because they wore glasses, and at that particular time it was really not cool to wear glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And I never saw Ulysses Williams in person, but it looked like his glasses were pretty thick. And that was one of the things that, I said, this guy is, and he was a very dark-skinned guy. And, I just basically say that you know, this guy was at one point was a real idol of mine. The only thing that I regretted was he didn't hit the tape. He ran the third leg. Mm-hmm. And I remember that same Olympics, the person that ran the third leg on the who passed the baton to Bob Hayes was also was a guy that I went to school with, Richard Stebbins. Yeah, Richard Stebbins, Dick Stebbins. Yeah, he ran the third leg and passed the baton on to Bob Hayes, and they became Olympic champions as well.
Yeah. Well, let's orient you on the question of the Freedom Summer and the impact. I got to say, this book to me brings out a problem that all of us, I think, have when we get kind of a basic story and we think we know what happened. That's why I really urge people, eyes have seen, and read it, because the makeup of the Student Nonviolent Coordinated Committee, they were so young and they were in such dangerous conditions. I mean, everybody always knew that ground zero somehow was Mississippi. And here this story is based right in Hattiesburg, which became sort of the crossroads of the fight. Talk about your family and reaction to that struggle. Do you have recollections of it?
That was in 1963, right?
Four, I believe. 64.
64? I went okay. In 1963, I was in Louisiana, and in 1964, I went back and forth, and I have relatives. My grandmother on my father's side was born in Goodman, Mississippi, and my great grandparents were from Mississippi. I met my great grandparents. There were George and Rose Glover, and they were from my grandmother, or great grandmother, was part Choctaw, and I remember seeing her, and she was very, very dark, and she had quote unquote good hair, and my grandfather was a very tall. He had, was it vitiligo, whatever that is, the skin disease. And he was a loud-talking, pistol-packing guy. And most people I would say most people had pistols in their houses.
Yeah. And hey, by the way, if I could just stop you right there. That's in the book, and I think it really is important to note that this idea that this was a group of poor, helpless people waiting to be rescued. Actually, this was a coping community. And one part of coping was, yeah, they had pistols and shotguns, and if you trifle with them, you'd pay the price. It really gives psychologically a different picture. I think the problem with some of the talk about the civil rights movement is it seems too much as a missionary thing. As though, oh, these poor people. My impression was that this is a very advanced people. They're very up. They understand what's going on. They're advanced in their food. They're advanced in their music. They're advanced intellectually, politically. They know the setting. So it's nice that these people want to come and help, but they have to be fitted into the struggle there. And just to go back to your point, yes.
Well, I was
your
saying,
relatives
my,
carried
my grandmother,
pistols.
My grandmother was had more guns in her house than I thought I was in the chapter of the Deacons for Self Defense. She had all kind of arms in her house.
Maybe they got their ideas from her.
And she always told me she was very quiet about. She would always say, and she said, I remember she was talking about the rebellion that they had in England, how proud she was to see the black folks throw Molotov cocktails at the white folks. Then she busted out laughing and said, she's, allegedly a Christian woman, so she's not supposed to be thinking like that. But she was very happy to see, that, and she told me that she was criticizing our generation. She says, you guys, she said, I like the fact that you guys are standing up, you know, to the power structure, but you guys talk too much. You know, it's like, and she would always share the quote from the Bible, never let your left hand know what your right hand are thinking. I'm not a biblical scholar.
Yep.
But she would quote that all of the time. And she was very well read. And unlike my grandfather, when I say unlike my grandfather was the direct opposite. He was my grandmother was almost 6 feet, and my grandfather was like 5'8", 5'9". And he, you couldn't put a white piece of paper in front of him. And he was very, 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 very militant. But I had found out years later, they never talked about it. His grandfather, my great-grandfather, Lewis Richmond, was actually lynched. Mm-hmm. And Lewis Richmond, it's my understanding that he was either schizophrenic or bipolar. So he walked around Louisiana talking about Europeans like Khalid Muhammad. You know, he called him everything but a child of God. Uh-huh. And the story goes that he paid the price for that. But I was never told that until... Well,
in this book, Fred Anderson has a cousin who simply made the mistake or had the accident of coming home took him along a road that got him right, you know, just walked into trouble, and he was shot many times and killed without any explanation. Nobody bothered to. It was just typical, Klan justice, I guess.
I remember Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael came to.
Now he's a product of that. What was your impression if he had to account for the struggle? What kind of things did he have to say about it?
Kwame Ture was born in Trinidad and Tobago. His mother was from Panama and his father was from Antigua. So Kwame Ture was a real Caribbean man. His father, like his father's from Antigua, mother from Panama. He came to New York, I guess, when he was 12. Went to school with a lot of Jewish kids, and he was, his upbringing was kind of different from ours. When I say from ours, because I grew up primarily with Chicanos. Mm-hmm. Mexican Americans, African Americans, and in my neighborhood, you know, we had it was basically Chicanos, African Americans, and Romas. You know, we had the quote unquote the gypsies, but Kwame, mm-hmm. I think Kwame's background was, and we were really segregated. But I think Kwame grew up with mixing. Or you know, commingling with all types of people. Yeah. And he didn't come to America until I guess he was 12. And you know, I remember, you know, we were always taught to leave the white woman alone. You know, if you see a white woman, leave her alone.
Kwame Ture's
quote was that you know, the white woman is not the Virgin Mary; she can't be had. And we said,
Well, Fred Anderson in his book talks about that. He says we had to learn the kabuki dance of maneuvering past white women. The kabuki dance. I hope that dance has disappeared. But what I was surprised at was, you know, it was just almost a moment. Because actually, very shortly after the Freedom Summer, and there was, let's remember, martyrs, Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner, who right at the beginning were murdered outright at the beginning. And they had to decide whether to go forward. And they did. It made history because there's no question that the concept of the right to vote took root, and there began to be pretty dramatic change. But politically, the word I would use is they imploded, partly due to external factors, which you're familiar with. They drafted the leaders, Bob Moses and Fred Anderson and other individuals who were key to the struggle, were targeted to be drafted, to grab them and put them in the military or put them in prison so as to put an end to it. What's your thoughts about that?
First of all, I started going to Muhammad's Temple, number 27, at 5606 Broadway when I was 14 years old. Patrice Lumumba, Maurice Sampolo, and Maurice Mpolo, Joseph Okito, Patrice Lumumba, they were murdered on January 17th, 1961. It was my first week at John C. Fremont High School. Mm-hmm. And what had happened was there was a guy by the name of, I guess I'll call his name, Charles Wright. And Charles Wright was a member of the Al Prentice Bunchy Carter's street organization. He was one of the renegade Slawsons. And he had an automobile. He had the best looking women. He had a car. And he was known to be able to fight. Uh-huh. And I remember when, you know, Lumumba got killed, Charles Wright was on the campus, and he was saying, "Oh, they killed Cassie, boo boo." I mean, he was like laughing, and I didn't like that picture. Mm-hmm. And there was a brother was looking at me, and he said, He called me over and he says, "Say, brother, look, say that brother right there. I see you don't like what he was saying." I say, "No, that don't make any sense for another to make fun of, you know, a black man to get killed." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Would you like to hear the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad?" So I says, "Who? The Honorable who?" You know, and.
I always thought that was a great title. I waited to hear the introduction when Malcolm X would speak of, always in the name of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Go ahead.
Well, they called him the Most Honorable, the Lamb.
The most.
He had all kind of names. But you know,
it's just like setting a note for music, in my opinion. Somehow, as soon as he said that, I was all ears. I was ready to listen.
Well, I went to the mosque. I went to the mosque, and I heard John Shabazz. Now, John Shabazz was the minister at that particular time, and John Shabazz became Allah Akbar Muhammad. Mm-hmm. He was the minister at. He started the Muhammad Speaks with Malcolm X, and that was like my boot camp, and. You know, I started, you know, listening to the teachings of Malcolm X and the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But I was not a religious person. My father was. Me and my sister, we always laugh about it. We can't figure out whether or not my father was an atheist or an agnostic. I know he was not interreligion. Period. He wasn't that crazy about Malcolm X because he thought...
He probably didn't think it was necessary to work that one out. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, he was not into Elijah Muhammad at all. Mm-hmm. He was kind of different. When I say he was kind of different, because most of my relatives, I shouldn't say most, but many of my relatives on my father's side were in the Nation of Islam.
Well...
There was one of my cousins, W.C. Williams, had a cleaners across the street from 27. He had a grocery store and a cleaners. Mm-hmm. And when they raided the mosque in 1963, he was a part of that whole situation because they were taking clothes from his particular cleaners. And I remember when the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad passed away, he lost his mind.
Mm-hmm.
He was so deeply off. He said the white man was the devil. We got into a big discussion about that, and he basically says that, you know, I love you, cousin, but even though I realize you're an agent, you're working for the CIA and blah 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 blah. He was gone. And I still love you, my cousin, and because he basically said, you know, the white man is the devil, and Malcolm was wrong, and da 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 da.
Yeah.
And well, you know, our family was split over, you know, the Malcolm folks and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad folks.
Yeah. Well, there's apropos of this notion of, well, drawing on biblical names, etc. Amazing that the man who was the center of this Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee,
Moses.
Bob Moses. Now, I think it's a revelation. Now, people should read the book, Eyes Have Seen, because I didn't know that Bob Moses had come to Canada under another name. He was living in Montreal. Did you know that?
Yes. Yes, I knew that. I knew that because I only been to Montreal like once or twice, and I knew, and he's mentioned in the book, Alfie Roberts. Alfie Roberts was one of the great people from Montreal. Alfie was a cricket player. He was from St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and a student of C.L.R. James, and he had many study groups. So yeah, and David Austin was born in Toronto, but grew up. He's still in Montreal.
Uh-huh.
So I went to 1976. I actually heard Richard B. Moore speak in Montreal. I'll never forget that. Richard B. Moore was the leader of the founders of the African Blood Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
He was born in Nevis, the same place that Minister Farrakhan's mother was born in.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, Richard B. Moore was, he was maybe about 6'4", maybe 6'5", very eloquent. I remember I heard him speak. He had a book, he wrote this book called The Term Negro and Its Evil Origin, and he had a bookstore in Harlem, and he's legendary. Yeah, Richard B. Moore.
Well, are you familiar with, I was not, and am not, frankly, the area, I think it's called Little Burgundy, Montreal?
I've been there, yeah.
It must have great bookstores, because Fred Anderson is a bibliophile, by the way. Shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. Hey, there's a point, too. As part of the diaspora experience, you know, I link this story of Fred Anderson to the Exodus period, you know, where people were getting out of the South at the turn of the century, the 20th, but they didn't forget where they were from. And I noticed he received books and assistance from uncles and cousins who were, you know, outside of the legally segregated South, and those were good books that they were sending.
Oh yeah, did
that happen with your family? In other words, people say, "Let's stay in touch. Send them this. Give them. Make sure they have the other thing, which would be not able to be picked up on bought on the street in Mississippi or the South."
Well, I had. I don't want to go into names, but I had people that, you know, that were directly in contact with my family, and you know, at that particular time, you had. You can go to a phone booth and make a phone call, you know. And I had links, yeah. And you know, family in Louisiana, family in Northern California, Southern California, and I think I had one uncle that was in Pittsburgh. And you know, on my mother's side, we had people in Chicago, who I never really linked with, but there was sort of like an underground communication situation happening.
Let me ask you about this. I noticed something. I want to get your comment on the. This book is rich in discussion of books and music and food, good Southern cooking, I'd call it, but particularly the music. Fred Anderson seemed to draw a lot on the blues. Now, and I guess, and I would have to say that seems to speak to rural black Southern culture. And there's a lot of citations of blues. I thought I knew a little bit about it. There's a lot of names I didn't know, but music is a backdrop to the struggle. And what were the voices in your mind in that period that people were listening to but that had a great message just sort of built into it?
Big Boss Man, Jimmy Reed, by Jimmy Reed. I remember listening to, you know, Big Boss Man by Jimmy Reed. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the music was coded, you know, calling out all around the world, dancing in the street. You know, people talked about that being dancing in the street, being the rebellion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Marvin Gaye played drums on that particular song. Mm-hmm. And at that particular time, a lot of Africans in America were attempting to do calypso. And
really?
I don't know, there's a debate as to whether or not it was because of Pan-Africanism or was it because that Harry Belafonte had sold 1 million copies doing calypso. I tend to believe a lot of it had to do with record sales.
Harry Belafonte has a role in this book. He and Sidney Poitier went down to meet with the Southern, the leader, I think it was a SNCC, as we called them, and other organizations, and brought them a lot of money. That was two wonderful men, Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte.
Sidney Poitier used to come to Toronto. I used to see him almost every day walking down Bay Street.
How did I miss that? What street?
On Bay Street in Toronto all the time, almost every day. I don't know, for some reason, the type of person that I am, I normally would.
You didn't stand in front of him and say, excuse me, I want to shake hands?
No. I always spoke to him. I think how you doing, Mr. Bell?
You did speak to him?
Oh, all the time.
Okay.
But I didn't. Normally, I'm the type of person, I'll get in somebody's face if I really want to.
Yeah.
But there was something about him that says, you know, like,
give him space.
Give this man some space.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just give Mr. Poitier his space, because I had and have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah. Well, definitely, I hadn't heard that before. Frankly, I have to say, I didn't realize the calypso. Although, once you say Belafonte. Belafonte was one of those people, he didn't need to do anything more than be Harry Belafonte and sing and conduct himself the way he did.
Well, you know, a lot of the Calypsonians said he put a lot of water in the wine. He watered it down. But Belafonte's image was the pretty boy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that in a negative way, but he had a way with the girl, with the ladies, and
I don't think anybody looking at him knows he couldn't help himself.
I remember seeing him one time. He's standing up there, shirt unbuttoned, talking to a whole room full of white folks, and cursing out the mayor of Toronto and cursing out the prime minister, talking about imperialism, and all these women are screaming and hollering. And this guy is talking about anti-colonialism. Yeah.
Really? Well, now, the experience itself, you went through it, and Fred Anderson did. And by the way, I mean, he was in a special situation. He changed. He took the name of Clifford Gaston, a boyhood friend, and He lived in Canada as Clifford Gaston.
Uh-huh.
And he was at risk all the time. And it should be. And so was, of course, Bob Moses. It's really remarkable. These two crucial individuals to the building of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee actually survived. And Moses made his way to Tanzania. I knew he'd gone to Tanzania. I didn't know he'd been here. And of course, we only learn about Fred Anderson because he's written the book Eyes Have Seen. But there must have been thousands in that situation.
Well, I took the name Otis Edwards, and I named myself. I was looking at a Temptation album, and I saw Otis Williams, the founder of the Temptations, and Dennis Edwards, who replaced David Ruffin, and I took those names. That was my name.
Mm-hmm. Were you? Maybe I've asked you already, but I want to make sure I clear. Were you aware that Moses had been here?
I don't think so. Yeah. No.
I got to hand it to him that they knew what they were doing. How about their style? These individuals that these are people who made a major contribution, but they are understated people. Moses. If I knew him, I'd say, I think you're a little too understated, because it's good that you're a leader who steps back, but we really need that kind of talent and personality needs to be better known so that people can model themselves a little bit on that kind of leadership.
Well, I don't know. It might be some of that Mississippi water, because I know a guy by the name of Charles Burnett, who is one of, I think his film is on the moon. I think they said his film, Killer Sheep. He's from Vicksburg, Vernon, and he never promoted himself. If you see him, he's very low key.
Yeah. Well, I believe they succeeded with this idea of don't just be there, but train others. And again, I have to say that Fred Anderson, he was about, if I estimate, maybe 17. I doubt that he was 18. When they first met him in Hattiesburg, and apparently it was his sister or aunt's idea that he'd go and have a look and see what these people were up to. But within 6 months, they're training him. I couldn't go into detail about that. And they actually gave him responsibility to go to another town and attempt to lead this voter registration business. That's pretty impressive, right?
Very impressive. I can't.
I wouldn't recommend they send me. I tell you that.
I know they couldn't send me at 14. I would be too busy trying to run track or try to be singing.
And the other remarkable thing I found is that when he came back to him and said, you know what you asked me to do there, I was talking to the local people, and they say, well, we cannot do that. We can do this other thing. And instead of Bob Moses and the others say, well, you know, we gave you the directions, we're the leaders, they said, okay, all right. And they made the adjustment to this, and this young man of 17, they're listening to him. That really, again, I've it's rare I read a book of this type, Eyes Have Seen, and where you get an interaction of leaders and members in a dangerous situation where the leaders are so calm and collected and rational that they know that a new guy is telling them something they better do.
Well, I think that has a lot to do with Ella Baker. Ella Baker was into the collective leadership. Like, if the people are the leaders, or we are.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to the people, as opposed to the vanguard leadership.
Okay. But tell, by the way, talk about Ella Baker a bit. Who's Ella Baker?
Ella Baker was from, I think she may have been from Virginia. But she was a leader of leaders. He trained Kwame Ture, Jamil Alameen, H.R.A.P. Brown is Jamil Alameen, Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael. I think she might have, I don't know if she trained James Foreman. I wanted to talk about James Foreman, but.
I love to hear these names.
Leader of leaders.
You know, we should call out the names, and I'll do it on the show more periodically. Just read them off. You and I have been talking, and we didn't say Fannie Lou Hamer, who really is close to being a saint, in my opinion. I don't know if we can get her into which church wants to do it, but she was amazing. Norman?
I just watched the video where Fred Anderson was talking about Fannie Lou Hamer.
Yeah. Well, we're going to do it a lot more. Norman, we're going to be talking to you more in the future about this whole subject. We really appreciate it. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Norman Otis Richmond, and the book is Eyes Have Seen, From Mississippi to Montreal, a memoir of Fred Anderson, Baraka Books. You better read it, because if you think you know what happened, and you haven't read this book, then I know that you're quite mistaken. This is The Taylor Report, CIUT. Pedro has done a great job. There's a wonderful show coming up, and we'll see you next week.